Welcome back to Cartels, Conspiracies, and Camarena. I'm Jack Llewellyn. Before we get started, a big happy Mother's Day to all the moms and mothers out there. I hope everyone is having a great weekend, great day today, and able to celebrate with friends and family. Also, before we get started, I want to make a recommendation. I did this last week. But on behalf of my friend Stephen Tubbs, who, as I said last week, is an award-winning journalist, longtime radio talk show host in the Denver area. He's the current PIO for the DEA Rocky Mountain Division. He's made a documentary on the fentanyl crisis called Devastated. You can find the trailer and all pertinent information at www.devastatedco.com. And after the 15th, so 15th is Wednesday, after that, you can stream the documentary on YouTube at Mountain Time Media, the Mountain Time Media YouTube channel. Please check it out. Support this timely and really important work. Okay. With that, let's talk about the topic of the day. This week, the Drug Enforcement Administration came out with its annual National Drug Threat Assessment. This one, of course, for 2024. And it's about 57 pages, more or less. And I've read it, so you don't have to. But there's a lot of stuff in here that's very interesting and directly pertinent to what we talk about on this podcast. So we're going to look at a couple of different things. We're going to look at kind of the overarching themes of the drug threat assessment. We're going to look at some specific comments about CJNG and CDS in particular. And then we're going to look at some of the discussions about specific drugs and how things have changed over time with respect to those. The threat assessment, the NDTA, starts with a note from Administrator Milgram, and then it goes into an executive summary. The first two sentences of the executive summary are pretty darn powerful. It says, "Fentanyl is the deadliest drug threat the United States has ever faced, killing nearly 38,000 Americans in the first 6 months of 2023 alone. Fentanyl and other synthetic drugs, like methamphetamine, are responsible for nearly all of the fatal drug overdoses and poisonings in our country." So that's pretty amazing. The other thing that's interesting in the report and the executive summary, a couple of paragraphs down, the executive summary says, "The Sinaloa cartel and CJNG, also known as the Jalisco cartel, are the main criminal organizations in Mexico and the most dangerous. They control clandestine drug production sites and transportation routes inside Mexico and smuggling corridors into the United States, and maintain large network hubs in U.S. cities along the southwest border and other key locations across the United States." This is important because, for all intents and purposes, the NDTA doesn't mention really any other cartel. There's one exception, and we'll talk about that in a second. But by and large, it focuses complete and total attention on CJNG and CDS. One other thing as a preliminary note in the NDTA is an assessment that Mexican cartels are present in all 50 states in the United States. Every single state is said to have some cartel presence, and we can talk about, you know, how presence is defined, but some presence in every state. just in case you're curious, the states with the greatest presence are pretty much the ones you would think of, with maybe an exception or two. So the states with the greatest presence of Mexican cartels, California, Arizona, Texas, Illinois, Florida, New York, and Massachusetts. Then you have a second tier that's pretty close to that, which includes Colorado, New Mexico, Georgia, North Carolina. And so those are kind of the places where cartel presence is the most significant, according to the DEA. Again, the big states: California, Arizona, Texas, Florida, Illinois, New York. The states with the least amount of presence include Wyoming, North Dakota, Vermont, New Hampshire, West Virginia, and Mississippi, and I think Rhode Island, but the map gets really small at Rhode Island. So the ones we know for sure: Mississippi, West Virginia, North Dakota, Wyoming, Vermont, and New Hampshire. But the real takeaway, I think, is the idea that the cartels are present in every state. As I said, the threat assessment spends a lot of time talking about the Sinaloa and Jalisco cartels, and we're going to walk through some of this. And I'm going to go into detail in certain places, less in others, but to try to give you an idea of what the DEA is saying, and also to highlight a couple of statements that I find very interesting and very curious. While I say that, I fully recognize that, you know, my knowledge of the situation in Mexico with CDS and CJNG does not compare to the DEA. So I'm not questioning that. I'm not saying that I've got better knowledge, but I do think there are interesting tidbits here that we can talk about. So the overview with respect to the Sinaloa cartel says the Sinaloa cartel is one of Mexico's oldest criminal organizations and one of the most violent and prolific poly-drug trafficking cartels in the world. They direct the smuggling of fentanyl and other illicit drugs into the United States every day, from smaller packages carried by human mules to thousands of pounds commingled with legitimate trade goods carried by tractor trailers. The threat assessment goes through what it describes as the leadership struggle of CDS, and it says the Sinaloa cartel's umbrella model. The threat assessment says the Sinaloa cartel does not have a leader. Instead, the cartel umbrella covers four separate but cooperating criminal organizations. This structure theoretically gives the heads of the independent drug trafficking groups the ability to share resources like smuggling routes, corrupt contacts, access to illicit chemical suppliers and money laundering networks without sharing profits or having to answer to a main chain of command. In reality, however, internal power struggles and fluctuating alliances leave the viability of the umbrella model in question. So I find that interesting. On the one hand, you have a statement that says this cartel is one of the oldest criminal organizations in Mexico, but then there's the question of the viability of the umbrella model. Here's what else is interesting. The four cooperating criminal organizations, as termed by the DEA, are these. One, Los Chapitos, as we know. Number two, El Mayo. Number three is Arellano El Guano Guzman Loera, the brother of El Chapo. And then four, it says, is Rafael Caro Quintero. Okay. That kind of struck me as interesting, and let me explain further. In going through the leadership struggle, they talk, the DEA does, about Los Chapitos. They talk about their uncle, the brother of El Chapo. Also talk a little bit about El Mayo, but basically say the stuff that we already know. El Mayo's reported to be in poor physical health, leading to some questions about the leadership of his faction going forward. Here's the one about Rafael Caro Quintero. Rafael Caro Quintero was a founder of the original Guadalajara cartel and one of the leaders responsible for ordering the kidnapping, torture, and murder of DEA Special Agent Enrique Camarena in 1985. He was sentenced in Mexico to 40 years in prison, but was released under cover of darkness on procedural grounds in August 2013 after serving only 28 years of his sentence. That same month, the governor of Mexico issued a warrant for his rearrest. Rafael Caro Quintero was finally recaptured in July 2022. Since then, Los Chapitos have been fighting his organization, known as the Caborca Cartel, for control of the Sonora Desert region, a crucial trafficking route through the Mexican state of Sonora to the Arizona border. Okay. I find it highly interesting that Rafael Caro Quintero and his group are getting as much credit, if you want, as much play in this threat assessment as they are. A well-known and pretty well-respected journalist in Mexico recently published a map of the cartels operating in different areas in Mexico, and he ranked them by the major cartels, which, as you would expect, Jalisco Cartel and Sinaloa Cartel, some more regional but powerful cartels. And then he described a group underneath that that were more selective groups, smaller groups, less powerful groups, more regional or more localized groups. The Caborca Cartel wasn't listed on any of those. Not to say that there aren't people there who talk about the Caborca Cartel. But remember, we talked that there was a lot of activity at various times prior to and maybe right after Caro Quintero's arrest, but you haven't really heard much from them. So again, I just find this very interesting, the idea that there is a branch of the Sinaloa Cartel, one that is attributed to El Guano, and two that's attributed to Caro Quintero and his followers in Caborca. The threat assessment then goes through and talks about some of the specific aspects of the Sinaloa Cartel, the drugs that it traffics in, and some other interesting notes. Of course, the main interest and main focus of much of the assessment is on fentanyl. With respect to fentanyl, the assessment says Los Chapitos and the Sinaloa Cartel reap billions of dollars in profits from the fentanyl trade and pioneered the deadliest drug threat the United States has ever confronted. The Sinaloa Cartel dominates the fentanyl market through its manipulation of the global supply chain and the proliferation of clandestine fentanyl labs in Mexico, a modus operandi they developed over a more than 25-year history of manufacturing methamphetamine. The Sinaloa Cartel has been producing bulk quantities of fentanyl since at least 2012, but the Chapitos faction is responsible for pushing the importance of fentanyl to the cartel's bottom line. Los Chapitos initially established a base of operations for manufacturing illicit fentanyl in the mountains near Culiacan. Now they control the procurement of precursor chemicals, largely from China, and direct the production of illicit fentanyl from labs hidden in the mountains of Sinaloa and another Sinaloa control, one more time, sorry, in other Sinaloa cartel strongholds throughout Mexico. The Sinaloa cartel controlled laboratories are responsible for introducing fentanyl in fake trademark pills to the United States market, while also churning out thousands of pounds of powder fentanyl every year. The assessment also talks about the fact that the Sinaloa cartel is directly contributing to the steep increase in methamphetamine-related poisoning deaths in the United States, which ranks second only to deaths caused by fentanyl. They also talk a little bit about the precursor ingredients, precursor chemicals required for synthetic drugs, including fentanyl. Some other drugs kind of have gotten less attention in the wake of the synthetic drugs, but the threat assessment notes that despite collecting billions of dollars in the illicit synthetic drug trade, the Sinaloa cartel has never stopped trafficking cocaine, heroin, and marijuana, nor stopped capitalizing on opportunistic drug trends. We'll talk about that in a little bit. We talked a while back on one of our episodes about the control the Sinaloa cartel has on maritime ports. That comment or that theme gets picked up in the threat assessment. And it says precursor chemicals have to get into Mexico before they can be used to make fentanyl and methamphetamine, and South American cocaine must arrive in Mexico before the cartels can traffic it across the border into the United States. Seaports, therefore, are a critical part of the Sinaloa cartel's criminal infrastructure. The port of Mazatlan on the Pacific coast of Sinaloa is wholly controlled by the Sinaloa cartel, and they charge other drug trafficking organization a piso or a fee for use of the port. The Sinaloa cartel maintains logistical and corrupt government contacts at other maritime ports on both coasts of Mexico. The threat assessment does note the port of Manzanillo, which is located just south of the Jalisco cartel's stronghold, which increases tension between the two cartels over that port. Finally, the assessment notes numerous complicit trucking companies work with the Sinaloa cartel to transport illicit drugs and precursor chemicals from the ports to Mexico City and other inland locations. Of course, there's other activities that the Sinaloa cartel is involved in, some of which, again, we have talked about on this podcast. A defining characteristic of all organized crime groups is involvement in any illegal venture that results in profit, drug trafficking being among the most lucrative. The Sinaloa cartel is most closely identified with drug trafficking, but are also engaged in extortion, the theft of petroleum and ores, weapons trafficking, migrant smuggling, and prostitution. In addition, the criminal links between the Sinaloa cartel and China-based chemical suppliers provide the networks for the trafficking of poached wildlife from Mexico into China. Members of the Sinaloa cartel conspire with Chinese organized crime groups in Sonora, Mexico, to traffic totoaba, an endangered fish prized in Asia, for its gas-filled sac or swim bladder. That fish is caught only in Mexico, and its swim bladder nets tens of thousands of dollars on China's black market. The threat assessment also makes a reference to the corruption. In Mexico, the Sinaloa cartel is able to operate freely in some ports and some parts of Mexico because they have a network of corrupt law enforcement, military, and political contacts. And then the assessment notes the conviction of Genaro García Luna, former Secretary of Public Security in Mexico, who was convicted in the Eastern District of New York, as we've talked about. And it notes that García Luna is the highest ranking Mexican official to be convicted of drug trafficking crimes in the United States. Finally, the threat assessment notes the global expansion of the Sinaloa cartel and says that the cartel operates in at least 47 countries around the world, and specifically notes that the cartel supplies methamphetamine to Asian countries like Thailand and to countries like Australia and New Zealand, where the cost of methamphetamine and therefore the profit back to the cartel is many times higher than in the United States. After going through this analysis on the Sinaloa cartel, the threat assessment does essentially the same thing with respect to the Jalisco cartel, which it notes is one of Mexico's most powerful and ruthless criminal organizations and another key driver of fatal drug poisonings in the United States. Since its formation around 2011 out of the remnants of the Sinaloa cartel-affiliated Milenio cartel, the Jalisco cartel has become wholly independent and now operates well beyond Mexico's borders, with a presence in dozens of countries around the world and all 50 U.S. states. The Jalisco cartel uses its vast financial resources, violence, bribery of corrupt officials, and franchise-based command structure to maintain and expand its dominance in Mexico's illicit drug trade. Key members of the Jalisco cartel are linked to bloody ties or marriage to the Gonzalez Valencia MLO, also known as Los Sunnis, many of whose members and companies are under U.S. sanction. Like the Sinaloa cartel, the Jalisco cartel reap billions of dollars of profits from the manufacture of methamphetamine and fentanyl, and are one of the main suppliers of cocaine to the U.S. market. In contrast to what the DEA termed the umbrella leadership model of the Sinaloa cartel, the Jalisco cartel uses, according to the DEA, a franchise model. It says the cartel is overseen by El Mencho and a small group of top-tier commanders who report directly to him. A second tier of regional and plaza bosses operate under the top-tier leaders. The franchise model permits each semi-independent group to customize its operations according to specific areas of expertise or market demands, provided they comply with naming, branding, and operational and organizational structure requirements and follow the general direction handed down by cartel leadership. The franchise model also enables the Jalisco cartel to expand quickly, since new franchises are easy to establish. The Jalisco cartel also maximizes their revenue through this model because leadership does not pay the operating costs of its franchises, but collects a percentage of overall profits. One of the key weaknesses of the franchise model, however, is that individual franchise groups operating under the Jalisco cartel name can form their own unique alliances with other criminal groups, some of which are in direct opposition to the alliances of other franchises. If you remember, we did a compare and contrast on the leadership style of the Jalisco cartel and the Sinaloa cartel, and we specifically referred to some work out of the Brookings Institute, which generally conforms to the analysis here from the DEA, but I find it fascinating. And I think we'll go back and look at those two analyses, this one in the NDTA, the one from the Brookings Institute. And again, part of the reason that I think it's so important to understand that is we know El Mencho and El Mayo both are in ill health, both are elderly. We could see a major transition in those cartels, at least in the leadership of the cartels. And I think understanding how they operate gives us a better sense of what might happen. And then if you're thinking of policy, you know, anticipating what could happen then informs your policy and maybe your views on things. The threat assessment goes through the same drugs, basically, and the same analysis that it did for the Sinaloa cartel. With respect to fentanyl, it says that the Jalisco cartel has become one of the largest producers and traffickers of illicit fentanyl in both powder and pill form. Although the Jalisco cartel cannot match the Sinaloa cartel's fentanyl production capacity, they have flooded American streets with fentanyl, often mixed with other drugs like heroin, cocaine, and xylazine, which we'll talk about in a minute. With respect to methamphetamine, the threat assessment says a straight line can be drawn between the cheap and deadly methamphetamine fueling addiction, violence, and crime in American communities, and the Jalisco cartel's involvement in methamphetamine production, particularly their investment in super labs. Every year, the Jalisco cartel brings methamphetamine into the United States by the ton, but the cartel's methamphetamine market does not stop at the U.S. border. Jalisco cartel-linked methamphetamine seizures have been reported in countries around the globe, including Japan and Australia, two of the most expensive and profitable methamphetamine markets in the world. With respect to other drugs, the threat assessment notes that the cartel, the Jalisco cartel, is a main supplier of cocaine to U.S. markets, especially on the East Coast, and they also traffic ton quantities of heroin and marijuana into the U.S. As with the Sinaloa cartel, control of certain maritime ports is important to the cartel. The DEA says that the Jalisco cartel has almost exclusive corrupt access to the ports of Manzanillo and Lázaro Cárdenas on the Pacific coast of Mexico, and can access the ports of Veracruz and Matamoros on the Atlantic coast, Gulf of Mexico. The threat assessment also talks about Jalisco cartel's involvement in organized crime, and notes that, like any other criminal organization, the cartel is involved in many other illegal profit-making schemes. The Jalisco cartel directs the theft of fuel from pipelines, extorts agave and avocado farmers, migrants, and prison officials, and taxes migrant smugglers. As noted a moment ago, the Jalisco cartel, according to the DEA, is active in over 40 countries in South America, Asia, Europe, and Africa. They have become competitive in these profitable markets very quickly, given their rival Sinaloa cartel's more than 30-year head start as a drug trafficking organization. The Jalisco cartel established distribution hubs in Mexico in early 2023 as part of their ongoing plan to expand into European drug markets. Last week, we talked about the use of social media by the cartels and how that's changed things. And the threat assessment talks about that in a couple of different ways. So initially, there is a discussion about the cartel's reach into U.S. communities. And the threat assessment says thousands of Sinaloa and Jalisco cartel-linked drug dealers in the United States bring illicit fentanyl, methamphetamine, and other drugs into American communities every day. A web of illicit drug wholesalers, only one step removed from the cartels in Mexico, operated in major cities throughout the U.S., like Los Angeles, Phoenix, Houston, Chicago, Atlanta, Miami, and others. Smaller branches of the cartels spread the drugs further, often using social media platforms and messaging applications to advertise their deadly products and recruit couriers and dealers. Just like their Mexican-based criminal counterparts, neighborhood-based crews, local dealers, and gang members endanger U.S. communities by selling fentanyl, methamphetamine, cocaine, heroin, and other drugs, and committing shootings, murders, carjackings, assaults, and robberies. The DEA had an operation that it talks about called Operation Last Mile, which tracked distribution networks across the United States connected to these two cartels. The operation confirmed that the Sinaloa and Jalisco cartels use violent street gangs and local criminal groups and individuals to flood U.S. communities with fentanyl and methamphetamine, driving addiction and violence and killing Americans. It also revealed that the cartels, their members, and their affiliated drug trafficking organizations in the U.S. use social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and Snapchat, and encrypted messaging applications such as WhatsApp, Telegram, Signal, Wire, and Wickr to coordinate logistics and communicate with victims. Operation Last Mile comprised 1,436 investigations in collaboration with federal, state, and local law enforcement partners, resulting in 3,337 arrests. DEA and its partners seized nearly 44 million, think about that, 44 million fentanyl pills, over 6,500 pounds of fentanyl powder, more than 91,000 pounds of methamphetamine, 8,497 firearms, and in excess of $100 million. There is a note about drug seizures. What's interesting is if you look over time at drug seizures, the seizures for heroin and cocaine have decreased dramatically, while there has been a rise in seizures of methamphetamine and fentanyl. We'll talk about that in just a second. One of the things that we've talked about in the past is the different ways in which fentanyl can be produced, the forms it can take, and the threat assessment says that these two cartels have been really good about making it in different forms, kind of having a diversification in the market to appeal to more users. And what it says is that the cartels manufacture fentanyl in different forms to make it appealing to more kinds of drug users. Powder fentanyl is easily mixed with or substituted for cocaine and heroin in regions of the United States where light-colored powder heroin is the norm. The cartels also make fentanyl in black tar form to cater to markets where black tar heroin is the norm. The eastern United States and the Great Lakes regions are associated with white powder heroin. Areas west of the Mississippi are associated with black tar. Multicolored pills known as rainbow fentanyl first appeared in 2022, pressed and marked with the same way as cartels using fake trademarked pills, but made pastel colors instead of the usual light blue. The threat assessment also talks about the Chapitos, stop fentanyl order. Remember, after a video was captured, October 2023, Los Chapitos said, you can't manufacture, can't sell fentanyl anymore. If you do, you've got problems. What it says here is the ban is probably a public relations stunt, however, or an attempt by the cartels to consolidate production amongst the smaller number of trusted manufacturers and to punish others. Throughout 2023, fentanyl was seized at the border in equal or higher quantities as in previous years, and no DEA field office reported that fentanyl is less available or more extensive, either of which would point to a decrease in the supply. I did mention nitazenes. That's a new drug that is something the DEA is thinking about. It is a synthetic opioid. like fentanyl, but allegedly it can match or surpass the potency of fentanyl. I don't even know how that's possible. There are a couple of charts from the DEA showing that nitazines, and there's different compounds of them, that the seizures and interaction with them have increased dramatically. Then there's another drug, xylazine, which is not a synthetic opioid, but it's found in a lot of fentanyl mixtures, and it makes the if you have overdoses, it makes the antidote or the normal action to prevent overdoses more difficult. As a result, it's responsible for soft tissue issues and a rash of amputations. It is a sedative, not an opioid. Interestingly enough, it is approved by the FDA as an anesthetic, but only for veterinary use. It's usually used as an anesthetic in veterinary medicine, primarily on large animals. So that's the next one coming down the line. Some of the old school, the OG drugs are still around, but having different impacts. The threat assessment says that heroin seizures in the United States began declining steadily, in direct contrast to a rapid acceleration in fentanyl seizures over the same period of time. Heroin seizures decreased by almost 70% between 2019 and 2023. In many drug markets, listen to this, in many drug markets in the United States, nearly all the heroin available at the street level is combined with or has been replaced by fentanyl. So I found that to be interesting. With respect to methamphetamine, one of the things that the threat assessment notes is the fact that smuggling methamphetamine in solution makes it much, much easier to conceal, harder to find. Obviously, it has to be processed because it can't be sold in solution, but it's the fact that it can be transported in that solution makes it hard. Drug seizures from of methamphetamine have decreased over the last couple of years, still high, and the number of deaths, as noted earlier, second only to fentanyl related deaths. There is a little bit of discussion as well about cocaine. The threat assessment notes that cocaine trafficking has been a persistent threat in the United States for 40 years. The Sinaloa and Jalisco cartels largely control the cocaine trafficking corridors from South America into Mexico, and then, of course, from Mexico into the United States. The cartels obtained multi-ton shipments of powder cocaine and cocaine base from South American traffickers, then smuggle it through land routes or coastal waterways in Central America, or by sea to Caribbean islands like Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic before bringing it into the United States. Once inside the U.S., U.S.-based criminal groups and street gangs distribute the cocaine, some of which is converted back to crack at the local level. Cocaine-related deaths have decreased dramatically. There had been a time period where the cocaine deaths were increasing. The statistics are interesting, and there's a bit of a discussion in the report about this. Sometimes it's hard to, if you have cocaine and fentanyl combined, if there is an overdose, is that a cocaine overdose? You know, does it fit in that column, or does it fit in a fentanyl column? And the fact of the matter is that when cocaine was increasing from, say, 2015 on, as far as deaths are concerned, most of those deaths were as a result of the presence of fentanyl, not from pure overdoses of cocaine. Interesting note, cocaine users are at a greater risk for drug poisoning from accidental ingestion of fentanyl because they do not have the tolerance of a habitual opioid user. In some parts of the U.S., at least two-thirds of the cocaine-related deaths also include findings of fatal levels of opioids, usually fentanyl. DEA and public health reporting on the rising trend of illicit drug consumers purposely using both stimulants and opioids, such as cocaine and fentanyl, is a growing concern. Marijuana, there's been a lot of discussion, some interesting articles in the last few weeks about the extent to which the legalization of marijuana in the United States, or in much of the United States, a likely legalization, at least in part of marijuana in Mexico, has decreased the price of marijuana in Mexico, made it much less profitable for many of the cartels. The threat assessment talks about the impact of marijuana in the United States currently and says, though marijuana remains illegal at the federal level, it has been either legalized or decriminalized for recreational use in 24 states and the District of Columbia, for medical use in 38 states, including the District of Columbia. And as of January 2024, Delaware, Minnesota, and Ohio are the most recent states to legalize marijuana for recreational use. Interestingly enough, despite these measures, it says, the black market for marijuana continues, with substantial trafficking by Mexican cartels and Chinese and other Asian organized crime groups profiting from illegal cultivation sales, as well as exploitation of the quote-unquote legal market. The price of marijuana in illegal U.S. markets has remained largely stable for years, even as the potency of marijuana has increased exponentially. And there's a great deal of discussion about the degrees to which the potency of marijuana has increased. We talked a few weeks back about some of the Chinese activity with respect to the marijuana market in the U.S. The threat assessment talks about it and says in recent years, there's been a notable uptick in the number of illicit marijuana cultivation sites linked to Chinese and other Asian organized crime groups. Asian investors have emerged as a new source of funding for illegal marijuana production in the United States, and site owners eager to protect and oversee their investments have been encountered at illegal grows seized in Oklahoma, California, Oregon, and Maine. Asian drug trafficking organizations have been involved in illegal marijuana cultivation for decades, operating industrial-scale indoor marijuana grows in residential homes, primarily in the western United States. Many of these home grows pretend to operate under business registrations granted by state licensing authorities in jurisdictions where marijuana cultivation and sales are legal at the state level. But absent overt evidence of such trafficking of marijuana across state lines or the commission of non-drug crimes, such as money laundering and human trafficking, it can be difficult for law enforcement to immediately identify violations or discover an illegal grow. Across jurisdictions with a state-level legal framework for cultivation and sales, Asian drug trafficking organizations defy restrictions on plant quantities, production quotas, and non-licensed sales, and hide behind state-by-state variations in laws governing plant counts, registration requirements, and accountability practices. In January 2024, a federal jury in the Western District of Oklahoma convicted two Chinese nationals of drug trafficking conspiracy, connected to trafficking nearly 28 tons of black market marijuana shipped from an Oklahoma grow facility licensed by the Oklahoma Medical Marijuana Authority. There's also some note in the drug assessment about other drugs, controlled prescription drugs, as they're called, that controlled prescription drugs account for the fourth leading cause of fatal drug poisonings in the United States. CPDs are supposed to be available only by prescription, but many prescription drugs are obtained illegally through fraud or doctor sharing or doctor shopping, sorry, sharing amongst friends or family members, purchased illegally on the street or online, including through social media and messaging apps. They also talk about prescription fraud. DA investigators observed an increase in fraudulent electronic prescriptions between 2021 and 2023. The further expansion of online telehealth services and e-script portals during the COVID-19 pandemic presented increased opportunities for e-script abuse by patients or staff and through identity theft. And then there's what they call new psychotropic and psychoactive substances, many of which are unregulated. And the DEA says they are a diverse group of synthetic substances designed to have effects similar to controlled substances. Users seek drugs in this category to attain a high equivalent to an illegal drug, or because they believe they can self-treat a physical or mental illness. Drug traffickers seek these drugs to skirt the law and diversify their profits. And then, of course, there's a discussion about illicit financing, most of which goes back to, or a lot of which goes back to China and things that we have discussed in the past. But the DEA says in the threat assessment, the Jalisco cartels and other global criminal networks generate billions of dollars in profits from the sale of illicit drugs. Drug traffickers use fraud and deception to circulate the money through the U.S. and global financial systems to enrich themselves and to continue funding their illegal drug trafficking operations. In 2022, DEA investigations led to seizures of hundreds of millions of dollars in assets that went through U.S. asset forfeiture proceedings. Most drug trafficking organizations outsource the cleaning of illegal drug profits to criminal money launderers and brokers who can provide quick upfront payouts to the traffickers while taking on themselves the tedious process of infiltrating illicit cash into financial institutions from within the United States. These money launderers usually do not work for one specific cartel. Rather, they accept money laundering contracts from multiple criminal organizations, not all of them drug traffickers, and use laundering networks that can span several counties and countries. The methods in which illicit proceeds are laundered include Chinese underground banking systems, as we've talked about, trade-based money laundering, in which consumer goods are purchased in one country for the equivalent cash value of the money to be laundered and then resold. You got mirror transfers, which is an informal system in which a broker in one country makes an upfront payment to the criminal organization and receives the equivalent amount from another criminal broker, cryptocurrency exchanges, and then simple bulk cash smuggling. As we've talked about in the past, cryptocurrencies are highly advantageous because they can be used to transfer value across international borders without relying on banks, and because these transfers leave no paper trail beyond the blockchain, which is encrypted, they're very, very hard to detect. Cash seizures, bulk cash seizures on the bulk cast seizures in counties within 150 miles of the United States and Mexico border in 2023. Arizona bulk cash seizures 2023, $6.1 million. In California, $5.9 million. Texas, $4.3 million. New Mexico, $1.6 million. So that, folks, is the basics of the threat assessment from the DEA. The key takeaways for me, again, are the description of the structure of the Sinaloa and Jalisco cartels, the virtual single-minded focus on these two cartels, and no obvious discussion about the impact of other cartels, though I'm sure that that's going on within DEA. And then the note of the differing and continually evolving drug trade itself. You know, you had heroin and cocaine and marijuana, and then, you know, now it's moved into fentanyl and methamphetamines, and then there's going to be the next product. And the challenges that that's always going to make for law enforcement in Mexico, in the United States, and around the U.S., around the world, sorry. And as I say, I'm going to go back and talk about the management style of the cartels in a later episode, because I think it's interesting. And I want to dig into some of the comments, especially with respect to the Caborca cartel, a little bit more. All right. That, my friends, is Cartels, Conspiracies, and Camarena for this week. Again, to everybody, happy Mother's Day. Remember Stephen Tubbs' documentary. Have a wonderful day and a wonderful week, and we'll see you next week on Cartels, Conspiracies, and Camarena. Thank you.